What's up, Dennis?
What's up, Bubbles?
Not used to seeing you without your hat. Brothers? You got like a nice supervillain look going to you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if it's the background or just the camera, but what happened, it looks like it took all of the hair on your head and it put it on the bottom here. I don't know if that's
Austin Powers, trick. Welcome to my underground lair. Mini-me, stop humping the laser.
Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And we are here a day late, but not a dollar short, because yesterday was a holiday. We took the day off just like the rest of you, but we're playing catch-up, and Jeff is back with us. Dennis is here, looking like a supervillain on his own private island, playing with his laser beam. What's going on, fellas? I just realized you just changed your background in like the split second. It was completely different. It was a rotation. You got a rotating background going?
Got a little Tarawa action going on there.
Nice. So, Jeff, you've been super busy, fella. What's been going on?
Yeah. It's, you know, the beginning of Living History season and air show season and all that, so yeah, I've been pulled a few different directions, and it's been a lot of fun having Dennis, you know, really fully integrated into the hobby, and being able to support and add on to the display, right? I mean, Don, you know, some of our listeners know, you do these events and you bring all the stuff and the tables and everything's heavy and you're putting everything out, and you know, you lose your voice after 2 days of talking to 10,000 people. And it's always nice to have a variety, right? I mean, I concentrate typically Air Corps. Don, you know, you typically concentrate Marine Corps. And I know over the last 10 or so years doing this kind of traveling, there's not usually a Navy contingent.
No, there's not. We're lucky. We have, sadly, he just passed away, and I'll talk about at the end of the show, but we had one guy down here who did a lot of it. And when the USS American Victory, the Liberty ship in Tampa Bay, would actually go out on the tours and float us around Tampa Bay, he would do his Navy impression and do a quite very good job at it. But yes, it's very true. Navy impressions are one of those that aren't done a lot.
Yeah, and it's odd because Navy was such a huge force. It was everywhere in the world, right? I mean, obviously you do Marines, it's PTO. But yeah, I mean, the Navy was responsible for so much in World War II and lost so many, you know, there were so many casualties that were Navy and you know, related. So it's refreshing to have Dennis come out, you know, not only as having a good friend, a fellow, you know, podcaster, but to have him side by side to add, to complement, you know, the displays that we travel with has really been, it's just been cool, and I got to say, I think the coolest thing so far here this year and the start of Living History season for us was watching Dennis become the inheritor of artifacts from another reenactor. I mean,
the watching him, you know,
watching stuff be dumped on him, handed over to him. He is now, you know, responsible for it because somebody else saw Dennis as... You know what happens, right? People are like, you're the person that can take care of this and appreciate it and build it into your display, tell the story. And, you know, I've been very lucky with that over the years. And to sit back and watch somebody else light up when they're opening this briefcase of all this amazing stuff.
It's like the scene in Pulp Fiction, like, when he opens the briefcase and the light hits his face. I just came up with a term. One man's duplicates is another man's impression. He just got his impression built out. Because when you've been in the hobby as long as we have, what tends to happen, you'll be walking to the flea market like, you know, I got 13 haversacks, but that thing's cheaper than a reproduction. And so you buy it, throw it in your... The next thing you're like, why do I have 13 haversacks? I know, I'll take five of them to the next event and offload some of them or give them away depending on, you know, how close that person is to you. So yeah, that's part of the community of this hobby. And, you know, we've had a lot of reenactors on the show over the years, but I don't think we've had a new-to-the-hobby reenactor, right? Most of the people come on here once they've done it a while. They've had their spiel down. So, Dennis, as someone who's new to the hobby and you're starting to get more and more acquainted with the people in the community, and you'll learn this. It's a small community, especially in your city, right? And so as you're going to these events, like, you start to recognize faces and names, and you kind of – you start to form your own little cliques and groups of people. Coming from a historian and an author and brought into this hobby, what's some of the things that either surprised you, stood out to you, or the things that you noticed or enjoyed? Just give us a, you know, a fresh eye look into the hobby and what other people who are thinking about getting into living history could look forward to. Your mic's muted.
I think that one of the coolest things that I got to witness, and one of the things that really stood out during that weekend, because that was the first time that I had my own impression, and I had three tables, and it was a great setup too. Wade and Jeff came up with this idea of making our displays in a circle, and or more of like an oval, and so we were on the inside, and then all of our tables pointed out all of the materials, and I had display boards and things that people could flip through, and then they had all their great stuff. So people were just continuously circling these tables,
living,
and they'd come back
the
over
round.
Multiple times, and it was a blast. But when you asked something about something that surprised me, it was seeing in the face of a woman in her 60s this shock, and watch her face drain when she looks over and sees Jeff, and immediately her eyes filled with tears and she started to smile and she said, "You look just like my dad."
Wow.
And was it her dad, Jeff, or was it her grandfather or uncle? I think it was maybe her uncle. Yeah.
That's crazy.
And it was a beautiful moment for her, because it was like he was alive again. And she got to, for that split second, see, and it was like, oh, there he is. Right? What's he doing here? And then the realization is that, of course, he's gone. But that split second impacted her so much that she asked Jeff if they could take multiple pictures together, and she was going to tell her family. Am I right, Jeff?
It was
very powerful.
Yeah, it really was. And as you know, too, that's the second time that's happened in the last couple months. We had a woman come up when we were in San Antonio, and it was her father.
That's right.
That served, and she was retired Air Force. He flew, I want to say, P-47s. She showed me a picture, and you know, the whole nine yards. And she kind of got a little teary-eyed. But yeah, the lady in Dallas, it was like, I almost was like, what happened? You know, because I didn't know, you know, you guys were talking, I was talking to somebody else. And so Dennis was facing out of the hangar towards where the ramp was, where the aircraft were parked. And then we had static aircraft inside. So I'm facing inside as the people come through the foyer. You know, so we don't see each other's conversations a whole lot. I just happened to look over, and yeah, she was just kind of looking at me. She was there with her husband. And yeah, at first I thought there was something wrong. Like, oh gosh, you know, what happened? Was there an accident outside, something? I had no idea. Yeah. It was just this emotion, just her seeing me, and her husband pulls out his phone and I think, pulled out a picture of her uncle and shows Dennis, and you were like, wow, you know, okay. And then they showed me, and she said he flew B-24s, and she said, could I get a picture with you? I said, geez, absolutely. I said, let's go take a picture in front of the B-24, fitting. And so I gave him my business card. I said, I'd love to have, you know, a copy of that and the original of the uncle. And they did that side-by-side thing and emailed that to me. And it, yeah, I mean, it's why we do that. This is why we do that. And it just keeps those guys immortal. And, you know, of course, right now on the heels of Memorial Day, there's no better time to help conjure those types of memories for people who had family that served in World War II. It just gives you a deeper appreciation. This goes beyond, you know, we all grew up watching movies and playing, and you want to be all of these things that you weren't, and that's fine. But it really kind of reiterated the true reason why we do this, and it just was a pleasure to, you know, just to meet those folks and have her uncle and just take a picture, just something as simple as a picture. And I will say that there was some resemblance. You know, the side by side, our crushers are cocked almost identically the same. Of course, it's the same uniform. He had a mustache. So, you know, it was just, there was, you know, some resemblance, but I definitely get why it struck her like it did, for sure.
You know, sometimes I got to remind myself, and I think probably a lot of our audience probably has forgotten this too. Living history was actually one of the first forms of history, right? Back, you know, years and years back, Native American times, back in caveman times, back in, you know, European times, before, you know, everybody was literate and could write, they would tell stories verbally, and then they would have the members of the tribe reenact the battles that they had with other tribes. And all the way up through history, yeah, it wasn't about World War II, but retelling the battles of how their tribes or how their grandfathers got to where they were in that point of history, because people weren't literate, it was done through dances, motions, reenacting battles, you know, different format, but at the end of the day, it's all very similar, and it's one of the truest forms of history. And it's kind of important of why we need to help keep that alive.
Yeah, it's very cool. And yesterday I was out at the cemetery out in the small town, Castroville. And Memorial Day, I had something I do with my girls. This year they weren't with me, but I'll go find the headstones of veterans that have been overgrown or covered with mud. Some of them are half buried under mud that from the rains. And then I'll restore them. I took a weed eater with me and, you know, scrub brush and this and that, broom and a couple other things, and you know, get it back to them that I had. I bought little spinners, little pinwheels at Walmart, patriotic pinwheels and flag, and some flowers, carnations that were red, white, and blue. And I put a flower and a flag and a pinwheel at each headstone. And when I was done, I decided to walk up the hill, because looking down, you just see all of the headstones and all of the flags where the veterans are. And it was just stunning, because this is a small town and it was just so many flags. And I was sitting underneath a shade tree at the top of this hill, just looking over everything. And I had my little harness and my Bose harness that plays music out. And I was listening to the song from Saving Private Ryan, Visitation to Normandy, where it shows the elderly gentleman walking up to that song was playing. I had it on a loop over and over and over again as I was doing this work. And as I'm sitting up there, and you asked earlier, Don, about how it was to then come into this community, I glanced down at the headstone next to me where I put my chair, and it is a fellow's named Mangold, and it says U.S. Army Air Corps, 8th Air Force. And immediately I was brought back to the weekend up there in Dallas, and the privilege I had to be there with Jeff and Wade, and it made me very circumspect in the way that I was processing what I was doing. And I pulled out this cigar that Wade had given me, and I sat underneath there, and I'm sitting among all these veterans, and I'm just smoking this cigar that was given to me by Wade, who's, you know, got his own impression that he does, which is always excellent, in the Jeep that he had there. And I made a little video, and I sent it to Jeff and Wade and told them, and I mentioned the other guys that I'd met. And it's interesting you said that, Don, because that's who I thought of out there. For some reason, I didn't think about my grandfather as much as I thought I would. And I didn't think about my great grandpa who was killed at Aachen, but I thought about what we do is so important, because it keeps all these guys, it keeps them alive, and it keeps their stories going, and they're not forgotten, not by us.
You know, you guys are talking about cleaning gravestones, and I saw a quick blurb on the story today, and it didn't even really, I was like, well, that's cool. But I think it goes in line exactly with what you're talking about. We can all agree that politics in this country are a mess right now, but check this out. I didn't know this. Is the fourth year of doing this. In the early morning rain, a group of congressmen some of them still in suits, after an all-night voting session, cleaned the memorial of 58,000 Americans killed in the Vietnam War. The group calls itself For Country. This is their fourth time, I'm sorry, this is their fourth year in a row washing the wall. Jack Bergman, a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General, is one of only three Vietnam veterans still in Congress. So these, a lot of these guys in the video scene, some of them are three-piece suits, some of them have their veteran gear on, but these guys, active congressmen, some of them are up voting all night. They're out there with scrub brushes out in the rain, soap, and they're cleaning the Vietnam Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., which is very, very cool to see.
That's cool.
And so shout out That's to them awesome. For that. Just because we're on the topic of living historians, Memorial Day, and the community. One of the things we all love about doing living history is the community, especially when you've been doing it as many years as I have. There kind of becomes, in your individual community, your states, your regions, a lot of reenacting is a regional thing. Like for us, we have Florida and a couple guys from Georgia and a couple Alabama boys always roll in. But there's always the reliable face, right? There's always the guys you know that are going to be there, or the guys that if they're not there, you're like, you know, this, what's going on with that? This year, the Florida Living History community, we've lost three of those gentlemen. We spoke about John Thomas about a month ago, 2 months ago. He's the gentleman who got me into doing First ID. Then about a month back, Jerry English passed away. Now, Jerry, I don't want to go on record to say his age. I don't know exactly, but he was probably in his late 70s. So he died of, quote unquote, natural causes. You know, he's been around. He was, him and John Thomas were both there. Like when I started, they were the veterans. They were the good two guys. And there was another gentleman that passed away too, which completely caught me off guard. He made the announcement a few months back that he had stage 4 brain cancer. And this is another contemporary of mine. The guy's probably 6 years older than me. His name was Mike Alvarez. Mike's uncle was in the 82nd Airborne in World War II. He was a historian through and through. He did Civil War, Spanish-American War, World War II, World War I, the whole gambit. He had the uniforms, the gear. He knew everything. I have a bunch of my photos, the 82nd Airborne demonstration I did where I'm sitting when we did that video. Mike's sitting behind me when we're walking out. Mike's in there. So Mike just passed away. His funeral was last Friday. He had some of his living historians doing color guard in full uniform. June 3rd, we're having the Zephyr Hills event where we're doing, obviously, D-Day, but we're also going to have a memorial to Jerry and Mike and John as well. But it got me thinking. We're all of age cats now, right? And World War II living history, Civil War living history, that's one thing. But I got the thing, it's not even relegated down to that. It doesn't matter if you're a little league coach, right? And all the coaches on your little league conference are all in their 30s and 40s. Or let's say you're a Boy Scout or whatever. Any sort of extracurricular activity that requires logistics, planning, organization, funding, you have a core group of guys, right? And a lot of those guys have been doing it forever, and they're getting older and older. And sadly, life happens, whether it's cancer, old age, accidents. These guys are going to start dying out. And all of a sudden, that community is getting a lot smaller, especially in areas like living history where we're not replenishing with younger kids, right? It's getting harder and harder. Well, for a while, we're starting to see a little bit of injection now, but it's getting a little harder and harder to replenish. But even if we are replenishing, what kind of happens is you got your middle ground guys, you know, the guys we like to show up, set up, and take on the least amount of responsibility, right? We just want to be responsible for our stuff and then leave. But I just want to remind everybody, and I kind of got pulled into this 2 years ago with VKE when Art retired, where Paul and I took over VKE, and now Paul, Nate, and I are kind of trying to do more to help maintain the living history here in Florida. But I just want to reach out to our audience, say, hey, if you're a living historian and you've been doing this for a while, you know your community, and you show up, you bring your impression, you're killing it, end of the weekend, you're picking up, you're going home, that's fantastic. But do me a favor, your next event, look around, see who your organizers are, see who your community leaders are, and ask yourself, who are their replacements? Who can we count on to keep this community alive in the event that something were to happen to them? And ask yourself, is that something that you could see yourself doing? Not now, but maybe just kind of stop. And once again, it could be Little League, whatever. Ask yourself that. And if the answer is even remotely yes, go talk to those people. Not say, hey, I want to replace you, but say, hey, can you kind of show me the ropes of this thing so I can help you out? And that way, when those cornerstone people pass, it's important for the love of the community. And as we said, keeping the history alive, we need to have people we can count on who are ready to step up if the moment calls upon them. And, you know, it's crazy to get to where I'm at that point now where it's like, I don't look at my age as like 46. I don't think that's old. But it's like in the last 5 years, I've known 4 people now in their 40s who've all passed away. And it's kind of like not so much a mortality thing, but when it comes to this sort of thing, just if you guys love your living history community, your book club, your bowling league, your Sunday softball league, whatever it is, just get to know the people who organize it and just ask yourself, for the love of whatever it is, would you be willing to start learning those roles so that you can take the place to help your hobby, your community live on in worst case scenarios? Because I think a lot of people, you know, showing up is cool, but sometimes if the organizers aren't there, there's not going to be an event to go to. So just put that out there in the ether, maybe to help revitalize some of the living history communities throughout the country and world.
Yeah, I think that's part of good leadership too. I mean, I learned that in the Army. When every time you're getting promoted, as you go up, you're looking down, grabbing the next guy and bringing him up with you, right? As you make E4, he's E3, and then when you make Buck Sergeant, you're pulling him up to be a good specialist, and so on and so on. So, yeah, absolutely. I think that's every leader's responsibility to, be able to name their replacement, or at least have a plan in place to where, in the event of something drastic, whoever does come in is not, you know, caught off guard. And I think that's important. That's definitely a lesson I learned over the years as not a very good administrator. I'm not an administrator. I don't keep good records. Anybody who knows me on social, like, wow, you know, I did all these amazing things. I don't even have a picture to prove it, right? I don't document what I'm doing. I'm living the moment.
Yeah.
I'm not taking pictures of it. So, but I mean, having been in several, roles with responsibilities in the community, in living history and so on. Yeah. That, to me, that's that person's job. That's part of the responsibility. And to your point with the young folks coming up, Dennis, I know you're probably thinking of him. That kiddo we met in Dallas. So we met a reenactor, Don. You're going to love this. I am probably the biggest Memphis Belle fan you'll ever meet.
Mm-hmm.
But I may have met a very close second. And the kid's not 18 yet. But his impression was spot on. And it's not just, oh, I'm 8th Air Force, or I'm 91st Bomb Group, or I'm 324th Bomb Squadron. No. His impression was the raid on November of 1942, early on in the Memphis Belle's career, when it was a low-level mission to the coast of France. It was not a high-altitude mission. So they wore different things. You know, so
that's what I was going to say. That's risky, yeah. Move going early, because the earlier you go, the harder the crap you're trying to find to be authentic is.
Right. And he even had the early war Mae West, the B-3. Inspection stamped and everything was dated perfectly. And the kid's not even 18 yet. So that right there really gives me hope. There is another generation that's going to take it over. I mean, it's just the natural course of things. But we cannot think that that's automatic.
Yeah.
It's up to this core group to kind of bring up the next generation, the passing of the baton, so to speak, and it'll come. And
Well, and plus we got to maintain his events, right? If we let, if we stop maintaining the event, stop scheduling, there's not going to be an event for the young kids to go to get fall in love with the hobby.
Right,
and
right.
And that's the other problem, especially, you know, I think I know I can name two museums in Florida over the last 7 years that have closed up. One of them was a beautiful museum up in Lakeland, Florida. Thing was immaculate. You walked in there. It was one of these things where it started out as a guy's private collection, and he kind of rented a space, and then through attendance and donations, you know, he had almost like movie sets. You go around a corner, you're walking down an alley in the French Resistance, and you see a store shop with a broken window. You look inside, and there's a German machine gun nest built in there with MG42s. If you go on my Facebook page, go back 12 years, you'll see photos from there. Guy passed away. Didn't really have a organized corporation to maintain it. Family was like, whoa, this is way too much for us. You know, only thing we can do is, you know, liquidation sale. And it's kind of like the old meme. What's the old meme? My biggest fear is I'm going to pass away and my wife sells my guns for what I told her I paid for them. And so, but yeah, I mean, and so, but more importantly, that was one less quality museum, or just one less museum in general, to have events, because they would have us out there twice, three times a year as a fundraiser for them. But for us to do Living History in this beautiful backdrop, it was just so awesome to do. But that's, you know, so in order to maintain this hobby and to maintain a community, you also got to, you know, find people to maintain the events. And more importantly, you got to show up, right? These guys can schedule events, go out and do logistics. I remember after my first tactical, Mike Blosky did a Marine Corps tactical, and it was awesome. We did another one a year later, and the attendance was down. And he's like, the amount of logistics and organization and the funding and all the stuff, the planning I put in this, that not having anybody show up, it's like, it just knocked the wind out of his sails. And so, you know, Jeff can tell you, this stuff is not easily organized. It's not easily done to find time on calendars that doesn't conflict with other people's events. And so, yeah, our job is not only to show up and do history, but to show up for the events to make sure they're going to be around next year and the year after that.
That Saturday was a freaking blast. We got up early and they opened up the hangar doors, and immediately a gust of wind blew everything, all of my displays down.
Oh, the value of paperweights.
The weakness was revealed, and I'm just like, oh man, I was super bummed. And so my mind, I'm processing, okay, what assets do I have? What do I got to do to keep these display boards up? Because they're awesome display boards. And there's, but I was looking off the side and I saw those stanchions that keep people in line or keep people from going off limits.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked and they let me use, so I put those on the table and the stanchion pulled it, the cord across. And then as the wind was blowing, it kept everything. It worked. That start of that day was just a blast. Yeah. Getting to meet everybody. The conversations, a fella coming up to me with a brief, he saw, you know, your table speaks about you, you know, as a person, as a historian, as a impressionist, as a person who loves World War II history and wants to preserve it. And this fellow saw that all the work that had been done and all the detail and the great artifacts and this and that. And he was feeling his mortality. He felt he had a close brush with death and had lost about 80 pounds and he looked skeletal. And all the next thing I know, he's coming up to me with this briefcase and he's like, this is for you. And I open it up and it's just chock full of World War II stuff. And it's all Navy related and pictures and dog tags and medals and ID cards and like so much.
Stuff would have taken you years to track down, especially nowadays.
Yeah, for sure. And here it was exactly what Jeff told me was going to happen, is that people are going to see what you do and the pride you take in it, and they don't know what to do with some of the stuff. And they're like, here's the perfect repository. And then the benefit is that your display gets better. After that, then
and more unique. because your display is built off of real artifacts that someone has collected 30 years ago, and you're not buying the same stuff that everybody else is trying to scoop together off of eBay or the reproduction stuff. To have something walk in that this guy probably has spent 20 years tracking down different locations, it's going to make your impression, your display, so much more unique than the next guy. Not that a lot of people are doing Navy, so you have that too. But yeah, you just can't beat a homegrown collection that someone has spent years organizing, especially if they started years ago. So as somebody who's been carrying a firearm for over 13 years daily,